Psalm 105. If you have been following along chronologically, then you know that we've just finished a study through the book of Exodus, which, as you might expect, was preceded by a study of Genesis. And that gives us good reason to study Psalm 105 today, because it gives an overview of the major events covered in our study thus far. If you've been following along with East Jordan's messages for the past few years, or if you've even just read the first two books of the Bible, you probably won't find anything here that you haven't heard about before. To that end, this will be a relatively short message. No need to labor over repeating things we already know. However, we should remember that ancient people did not have the kind of direct access to history that we have today, and so, despite having a lengthy historical record, having a brief psalm like this one as an overview was particularly helpful for the ancients, and that's why it's included in the scriptures. Today, the common man can have his own copy of the Bible, something which would have been impossible in the days before mechanized printing. And not only that, but with the advent of the internet, you can have instant access to commentaries, study materials, and sermons like this one with the touch of a button. So this is a pretty easy review for you. However, in older times, one of the best ways to give people access to information and to help them remember it was to give it to them in song during public worship. And I have no doubt that that was this psalm's purpose. In those days, educating people was much more difficult, but the congregation of God's people could hear this song sung, and it would briefly teach them a history which they might otherwise not have easy access to learn. And since it was set to music, it would also make that history easier to remember. So then, if you haven't yet read today's passage, it is Psalm 105, and I recommend that you pause and read it now. The psalm opens, through the first six verses, with a call to give thanks to Jehovah, to sing his praises, and to rejoice in his name. And of course, where a person deserves thanks and praise, there is a reason, and that reason is good works. And so throughout these verses, the psalmist says that we should remember the good works which God has done, that we should tell of them, and that by our telling, those good deeds should be known among the people. And so for the remaining 39 verses, that is exactly what the psalmist will do. Give a review of God's good works. And I hope that stands as a challenge for you. We also should praise God for the things that he has done, and of course, to praise God for what he has done, we must know what he has done. And once we know what God has done, we have a duty to go out and proclaim to others what he has done, so that they too can glorify him. That kind of glorification of God, I dare say, is the primary focus of the Christian life. So, learn about the things which God has done, and be sure to tell others about them as well. Of note, there is a suggestion here that this psalm was written not long after Israel had taken the Promised Land. The author says he will speak of God's great works, and he speaks of them right up to that point in history. It seems that if there had been great works after the conquest of the Promised Land, the author would have mentioned them, but he didn't. For that reason, I speculate that perhaps the author lived in or around the time of Joshua. But that, of course, is just speculation. It could just be that the end of Moses' life was a good stopping point. In verse 7, the psalmist begins to consider those great works of God. In the first place, God is praised for his very nature. He is given honorable mention as a just God, whose judgment is in all the earth, and is praised as being not just any God, but our God, the God who made a covenant with his people Israel, and ultimately who reached to the whole world. The psalmist notes this covenant would stand for 1,000 generations, a poetic descriptor of forever, no doubt. The covenant with God and his people, of course, reaches all the way back to Abraham, to whom, you will recall, God promised to give the promised land and to bless his descendants. That covenant passed on through Abraham's son Isaac to his son Jacob. Those men, whom we call the patriarchs, spent their generations with few people, little influence, and no large share of land, and yet they were not oppressed, thanks to God's divine protection. The psalmist relates, beginning at verse 16, that after the time of those patriarchs, Jacob's son Joseph was sent down into Egypt as a slave, emphasizing the difficulties of his slavery by noting that he was bound by a collar and with fetters. However, during the famine, God raised Joseph up and set him free to serve close to the rulers of Egypt. God did this, as is noted in verse 19, by giving Joseph his words, the prophetic interpretation of dreams, which impressed the Egyptians who had imprisoned him. In some English translations, verse 19 says that God tested Joseph, or some such. I think that the King James, God tried him, is probably a better rendering of the word. Though Joseph had been imprisoned without a just cause, he ultimately received a fair hearing from God and was given the justice he deserved. Verse 22 tells us that Joseph was given great authority in Egypt, such that he could be expected to both instruct the officials of that country and to bind them, forcing them to comply with his dictates. After this time, all Israel came to sojourn in Egypt, here called the land of Ham, after the man from whom the Egyptians descended. The psalmist notes that when the people began to multiply, potentially to a point at which they might overrun Egypt, that the Egyptians began to mistreat them. It was then, as we read in verse 26, that God sent Moses and his brother Aaron to deliver the people. Moses, as we know, performed great miracles. Exodus records 10 plagues which Moses sent, and the psalmist here records the plagues of blood, frogs, gnats, swarms, with English translations providing the word flies, though that is not in the Hebrew, hail and fire, locusts, darkness, and death on the firstborn. The psalmist skips the plagues of livestock and boils. In verse 37, the psalmist relays how God brought his people out of Egypt, noting that they were laden with the riches of their former slavers. In verse 39, we hear a description of Israel's experience in the wilderness. Particularly, the psalmist notes God's appearance in the pillar of cloud and fire, and also his divine providence in feeding the people with quail and giving them water to drink from the rock. Verse 43 begins the conclusion of the narrative, noting that God's people sang to him for joy on having been brought out of Egypt and into the promised land, of which the people took possession. Thus, God upheld the covenant which he had promised to Abraham, the point on which the psalmist had initially invoked praise to God. The psalmist concludes with a reminder that the people, having been given a good land, received it so that they could glorify God by upholding his laws and statutes, the bulk of which we studied when we considered Exodus. And finally, we are given one last encouragement that we should praise Jehovah. So that if you are very much familiar with the Bible, then there probably isn't any shocking information there. The psalm is primarily a review of Bible history from Genesis through Exodus, and we've covered everything that it mentioned in previous sermons. The psalmist here called on the congregation to remember God's great works and to glorify him by spreading the news about them. Let that be our goal at East Jordan, and your goal in life as well. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.